Today's Veterans Radio is dedicated to the memory of our partner, Gary Lilly, who was killed by a drunk driver 2 years ago on the 4th of August, 2011. Never forget, always remember.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. Yes, our program today is dedicated to our late partner, Gary Lilly. As I mentioned, was killed by a drunk driver 2 years ago.
And was that it? Just two?
Just two.
Feels like five.
I know. It's very sad, and we are going to be talking about Gary toward the end of the program a little bit. So if you've got a comment you'd like to make at that time, you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. Gary, we miss you. We can't even express how much we miss you.
What have you done for a vet today?
That's true, and that's something that I say to myself every day, and I try to live up to that mantra if we can. We've got a lot of things going on Veterans Radio today. We're going to be talking again about the Battle of Gettysburg and the effect that it had on the Civil War, and actually the effect that the whole battle and the Civil War had on the country. And again, if you'd like to participate in the discussion, we're going to be asking the question of our guests today, what would have happened if the South had won the Civil War? Where would we be today? It'd be very interesting, I think. So I want you to get your little notebooks out, scribble down your questions, and give us a call after our first break when we bring our guests back on. For those of you that would like to listen to our first program about the Battle of Gettysburg, just go back into the VeteransRadio.net archives, and it was the 6th of July, 2013. And I think you'll find it fascinating. We didn't finish
ago.
About it. Pardon?
It was a month ago.
It was a month ago.
That's right, 4 weeks.
Yes, I know. Well, you know,
our
guests are very busy, and it was very hard to get everybody back on the same, you know, same page in a short time. But this is what we do here at Veterans Radio,
yeah,
because
right.
We wanted to complete the program. Also, you can find out more about Veterans Radio, as I said, at our website. We're on Facebook, and we're on Twitter. How about that? Although Maria is not here today to send out her messages, feel free to contact us by either one of those forms, I guess you call
it.
Forms of media, right?
I shake my head.
Right, and our handles are /veteransradio at either Facebook or Twitter.
Thank you. Isn't it luckily that we have Nina there, our technical director.
Lucky we have somebody under 80 here.
Anyways, we got a program coming up next week that we're really excited about, and we're going to kind of preview that right now.
Very quickly.
And, Bob, let's talk about over Michigan.
August the 10th and the 11th is going to be the annual Thunder Over Michigan. I know every week you've heard us talking about that. But, boy, what an exciting event. I was down there the other day at Yankee Air Museum because we're going to be conducting some interviews. The theme of the whole program on August 10th is going to be jobs. Jobs, 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 jobs. We get a job. Hey. Well, you know what? If you know of a veteran, a neighbor who's a veteran, or a cousin, or a nephew, or a grandchild, or whatever, or yourself, we're going to be concentrating on jobs next week. And we're going to have two major corporations, Dale. Walmart. They're going to hire 100,000 veterans in 5 years. Did you hear that, folks? 100,000. Get those resumes. I don't know how to make a resume.
And you're not going to be a greeter.
Oh, no, 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 no,
a little name, no.
No,
that's not the jobs we're talking about.
High-tech. Absolutely.
High-tech
jobs. A lot of IT stuff, a lot of IT stuff. But resume, I don't know how to make a resume. Well, I'll tell you what you do. You go to your local Veterans Administration, and they do have, I think it's VA jobs, VA.gov. Sorry, should have that. Maybe by the end of the program I will. But you go there, and there is how to put a resume together, all the things that you need to do to go out there and do some real fruitful job search. So we're going to have Walmart and Quicken Loans. Mr. Dan Gilbert, a big veteran supporter, and the Walmart people. So they are in modes right now to hire veterans. Why are they hiring veterans, Dale?
Because they know that they're dedicated. They know that they're dependable. And they We show up. We know how to follow orders. And we also know how to improvise if necessary.
And don't complain either, man. Remember?
And I think that's what's interesting about both of these organizations is that they have separate departments designed to provide jobs for veterans. They have special programs going on out there. I know that we talked briefly with Quicken Loans, I think it was last year at the VA job fair in Detroit. They've got a man in charge of the whole program.
Oh, and he's an Army vet.
Hiring veterans and getting the word out. The VA hospitals or the VA programs that are out there to make up resumes. And so, there are so many reasons and so many opportunities for you veterans out there to find jobs. There's no excuse.
Exactly.
Get out of your bunk and go and find these things, and they'll help you find a good paying job.
Dale and I have been talking about this from time to time, and we do hear, well, it's a tough economy. Well, you know what? There is an opportunity now. They are out there. You got to go out and do a little bit of digging. So other than having a brand new suit to wear, I don't know, perhaps there might even be some.
There are even programs out there that will get you a suit.
And your haircut. And ready to go.
Right.
Okay,
just
folks.
Just trimming off the sides.
Next week, August 10th, right here on Veterans Radio, Jobs, Jobs, Jobs. It'll be all about jobs, and you won't want to miss it.
Right, but we also forgot to mention that the Thunder over Michigan is also going to be on next week. That's at Willow Run Airport, the Yankee Air Museum.
Static
displays. It's yankeeairmuseum.org. And also, we're going to be out there.
Talking to some of the pilots.
Talking to the pilots and so forth. Myself and Maria will be out there. We'll be there all day. You'll be able to find us because we'll be the ones looking at all the aircraft with our mouths open going, oh, that's amazing. Oh, and hopefully get a nice little ride on a Huey.
They're going to have a squad of those Sky Raiders.
And what kind of airplane?
The Sky Raider. Did I say that right? Yeah,
Sky
Raider.
I believe so.
Yeah. And the Sky Raider was all the way into the Vietnam War.
Yes.
From World War II to the Vietnam War. And so, they will be there. And
we're going to be talking to those people. We're going to have static. There are going to be all kinds of displays
there. Bring your camera.
The other thing I wanted to remind you just real quickly is about the Yankee Air Museum, and we talked about this on a program, is they're trying to save the bomber plant. As you know, the B-24s were built at Willow Run. During World War II, 1 an hour, 8,000 of them over a three-year time period.
Every 55 minutes.
And the original bomber plant, although in disrepair, is going to be torn down to redevelop the property. The Yankee Air Museum is trying to save about 100 yards of the building, and they got an extension on their fundraising. They need to raise $5 million. They've raised about $3.5 million from what the last I saw. So if you're still interested and you like the concept of preserving America's history, go to SaveTheBomberPlant.org. And click on there and make your donation to save that bomber plant.
Hey, even if it's $50, you know what's on the way to preserve. And that's things that we do here at Veterans Radio, folks. One of our mantras is that we are in existence to help bring a voice to the vet, but to encourage the savings of memorabilia and artifacts and museums and things.
Right. As a matter of fact, the Yankee Air Museum is always looking for military artifacts, uniforms, and so forth. So if Grandpa passed away and you got a trunk full of uniforms, here's a place where you can donate it and not just get rid of it. It's got a story behind it.
I was in the gift shop the other day. Oh, I love it because I got those metal planes. Yes.
Yeah,
and that Mustang, I've got my eye on a P-51 Mustang. I'm just looking at metal, too, so it's real cool. Yeah, plastic.
Yes. Well, you know, we could go on about this, but we gotta get back to the Civil War in here and solve the program and solve the problems of what happened at Gettysburg. We'll be back in about a minute or so to talk to our guests about Gettysburg and the effect it had on American history. And the question to you, our listeners, to get in on the conversation is, what would have happened if the South had won the war? We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we are back on Veterans Radio, and we're going to be talking about the Battle of Gettysburg. And if you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call here at 877-573-7825. First of all, I want to welcome back our correspondent from Firebase Brooklyn, and that's Dwight Zimmerman. Dwight, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale, and hi there, Bob.
How are you doing, Dwight?
You know, the reason I want to bring you on first is to talk a little bit about try to review for our listeners what we talked about back in July about the Battle of Gettysburg and how the Medal of Honor, which you are a known expert on the Medal of Honor, began actually during the Civil War, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Medal of Honor was created, well, the idea of a Medal of Honor was brought forth by the Army, but General Winfield Scott was in charge of the Army, and he didn't like the idea because he felt it was too British of a decoration. And as a result of that, the Army passed on having it, and the Navy decided that it would pick up this medal because they thought it was a great idea. The Secretary of the Navy decided that it would boost morale and really help them at a time when morale was suffered.
Didn't the Navy, I guess it was the Navy, didn't they want this mostly for enlisted personnel?
Initially it was only an enlisted decoration. It didn't change to being eligible for officers until World War One.
I have a quick question. I know this is kind of blindsided you, but do you know how many Medal of Honors were awarded during the Civil War?
Originally, almost 2,500.
And how many of those were rescinded for various reasons?
Well, ultimately, there were 911 rescinded in what was called the Purge of 1917, which looked at getting rid of medals that were given for basically non-combat situations. Infamously was the 27th Maine Volunteer Infantry Regiment, in which all 864 men received the Medal of Honor for re-enlisting. They performed garrison duty during the period of the Battle of Gettysburg, and in point of fact, only about 300 of them re-enlisted. The rest returned home after their service was up. The way that the citation was drawn up, it was so poorly worded that everyone got it. Now, needless to say, there were those who received their decoration as a result of combat action didn't exactly like this fact, and they fought for years to tighten up the regulations and to disallow these decorations that were given to people like the men of the 27th Maine.
Right. I can certainly understand that because there's so many, and this is a whole other program, Dwight, that maybe we'll have to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Craig, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Okay. Sorry. Well, we'll get to...
And Wayne, I'm here, too.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We're back on. We had some sort of computer glitch there. This is why Bob and I are not allowed anywhere near the control room, although we didn't even...
We
weren't even there. We weren't even there, but we're back. So we'll just edit all this stuff out. And if you could put Bob's mic on, we'll be all set to go. All right, Bob, you're back.
Yes. I did have a comment, but let's go on.
All right. Anyway, and we're going to put Dwight back on here, too. We're talking about the Battle of Gettysburg, and Craig, I want to come to you first. Last time we chatted, we had just gotten to Pickett's charge and what was going on, and I was trying to do some reading. How many men were involved with on both sides with that?
Well, Pickett's charge is a bit of a misnomer to begin with.
Okay.
Pickett had a division of about 5,000 men, but it was one of three that participated in that assault. The other two cobbled together from troops from other units. The number most people land on to decide about the total number who participated in the charge is about 12,500. Estimates go up to about 15,000, which would be the number if the three divisions were full strength, but the other two were not. So it was Pickett's division and Pettigrew's division, and then another division cobbled together under the command of a Marylander that was just put together from leftover pieces from other units after the first 2 days' fighting. So somewhere between 12,500 and 15,000 men.
And they were attacking the northern troops, and how many northern troops were there in that particular area?
Well, in that particular area, probably somewhere between 3,500 and 5,000, depending on how far out to each flank you want to go. It's roughly a 3-to-1 manpower advantage on the part of the attackers, which is what you want. Of course, not every attack has to cross nearly a full mile of open ground,
right.
So that's one of the problems, obviously. But about 3-to-1, 15, let's say 15,000 to 5,000 to use round numbers.
Now, this is Bob Gould. Every time I see this, and here was Lee, he was a general. And I'm not a general, and I haven't had really any West Point military training, but even I could see that this was suicide to go in that much open field with all those cannons. Why did they still do it?
Well, you know, everybody who stood at the Virginia State Monument there on the grounds of the Gettysburg battlefield and looked across that open mile at the clump of trees that Lee used as a guidepost for Longstreet in the attack, asks that same question. What was he thinking? Why did he think this could possibly work? I think I can make a pretty good case for why, at the time, the decision made sense. But to do that, you have to back up to what we were talking about last month and remember that on the first day, Lee had both a numerical superiority and momentum, and he drove in the right flank of the Union Army, drove them all the way through town and up on the cemetery in Culp's Hill. Then on the second day, he attacked on the other flank, the Union left flank, and he drove them through the peach orchard and the wheat field back up onto the low end of Cemetery Ridge. He had the Union back on their heels. He had attacked the right. He had attacked the left. The center had been weakened to strengthen those two flanks. That was the critical spot. And he also, remember, prepared for this attack by massing his artillery in the center of the line, and probably about 140 guns, most of them 12-pound Napoleons, firing in a constant salvo from 1 o'clock almost to till the time of the charge. I have speculated elsewhere that this was the loudest man-made sound in the Western Hemisphere until the explosion of the atomic bomb at Alamogordo. It was an enormous, what they call, preparation of the battlefield by artillery. And his notion was that the artillery would do two things. It would shatter the morale of the defenders. It would force them all to hug the ground, keep their heads down. It would create a great deal of white smoke from the black powder through which the troops could advance, come across those shell-shocked defenders who had lost on the first 2 days, pierce the center of the line. Stuart would come riding down from behind. The Union Army would be shattered. It would be not just a victory. It would be an annihilation, and the war would be over. So that's the scenario that he created in his mind. And we can look back on it now and say, well, you know what? That doesn't look like very likely. But when we stand there on a nice summer day, when there is no smoke and no sound and no artillery, and we look across that open mile, we think that's not possible. But, of course, Lee created the conditions where he believed it could be possible.
Well, Wayne, would you like to jump in on that?
Well, as I say, I wasn't there, so I can't say for sure, but it seems like a long shot.
Which Dale
the,
was.
Which the whole campaign was a long shot. I mean, Lee was more concerned Well, really, you know, he looked at more of his state than he did his country, so to speak, which his state was his country.
Right.
And it was just a long shot. And, you know, of course, the war itself was a long shot. So I don't know. I'm sure it looked real good at the time, as Craig said. But it sure didn't turn out that way. But, hey, things in history turn around. But
that's true. I was thinking the same thing that both of you have mentioned there. I've been to to that area of Gettysburg, and you just look at it and you go, what was he thinking? But then, Craig, the way that you described it, yes, in the confusion and turmoil and all the other things that were going on, it seems like it could be possible.
Well, there was one more thing, too, that was in Lee's mind. I think Lee, having fought the war for most of 2.5 years, and having served before he was commander of the Army of Northern Virginia, he was Jefferson Davis's military advisor. So he had seen the war from Richmond as well as from the battlefield. And he knew the assets that the South had, which was its grit and its guts and all that business. But it knew also that it didn't have the railroad mileage, the telegraph wires, the manpower, the industrial infrastructure that the North had, and that a long war was not to the South's advantage. He really felt it was necessary to strike a knockout blow and get this thing over with before the North fully assembled all of its massive power and just steamrolled the South. So rather than play this thing out year after year after year, you know, the Union armies had come across the Potomac and the Rapidan River and gotten their nose bloodied and retreated time after time from Manassas through Chancellorsville. Well, here was a chance to end this thing now. And if it went on for another year and a half, the South would lose. And, of course, that is what happened. So he was desperate to strike a knockout blow if he could. And he saw his best opportunity here. His opponent was not dug in. There were no field entrenchments at Gettysburg. The numbers were about even. He'd never had that before and never would again.
Right.
So this seemed to him to be about the best chance he had.
You know, it's amazing.
Oh, I'm excited just to listen to it.
it's amazing when you think about what the possibilities were if that would happen. And that's what I want to kind of get into with you three today. What would have happened, do you think? I read a story the other day as I was kind of trying to research this about, and maybe this is a wives' tale, I don't know, that Lee had some sort of letter he was to deliver to Meade if he had won the battle about how they were going to end the war. Anybody can comment on that?
Yeah, it's true that when Robert E. Lee went to Jefferson Davis and asked for permission to do this, Davis was reluctant. Davis wanted to defend the Confederacy everywhere. It was Lee who said, we really need to take the war to the enemy. And Lee convinced Davis that it would have a political ramification as well. So he did have a letter, but it was not, I think, the purpose of the battle. It was it existed in large part because Lee used that possibility to entice Jefferson Davis with the possibility of ending the war. So Davis agreed to write a letter asking for representatives of both sides to meet, to call an armistice, first of all. And, of course, once you call an armistice, it's very difficult to go back to fighting. Nobody wants to start over again once it's stopped. So to call an armistice during which representatives of the two sides would meet. But, of course, the South had offered this before, and the Union was not going to accept representatives from a country it did not recognize. As far as the North was concerned, the Confederacy was not a country. They were all rebels. So they weren't going to – I don't know how seriously to take the existence of that letter.
Okay. Wayne, I wanted to ask you, we got about 2 minutes.
Sure.
In addition to Gettysburg going on, at almost exactly the same time, we've got the Siege of Vicksburg happening.
Right.
On the western edge. So you got to wonder what the masterminds of the South were wondering what's going to happen next.
Well, you know, this all of a sudden just occurred to me, and I'd like to ask Craig this question. What if the South had, if Lee had won the Battle of Gettysburg, we could have still lost the war. I'm not saying we. The South could have still lost the war. I'm a native Southerner. I think the right side won, but I do believe. I wonder if that possibility. I've never thought about that before. But as I say, they were so spread out. We didn't have the infrastructure for this war, and we could have probably won the Battle of Gettysburg and still lost the war. That just probably had a lot to do with the. If the North had the sticking power. What do you think about that, Craig?
I think that's probably right. You know, let's imagine, for example, that Lee got this thing worked out and Pickett actually does break through the line and Stewart comes riding down behind and all works just the way he planned. And the Union Army has to fall back in disorder back to its secondary line near Westminster, Maryland, along Pipes Creek, which is where Meade would have gone under those circumstances. Lee's problem is this. He's got between 20 and 25,000 wounded men on the field. He has no supply line. His line of communication stretches all the way back over the Cumberland the South Mountains, down through the Cumberland Valley and through Harper's Ferry back to Virginia. So he's not getting any supplies or ammunition. He's fired off almost all the artillery ammunition he has in that preliminary bombardment for the attack. So he needs powder, he needs food, he needs supplies, and he's got to take care of 21,000 wounded. My guess is he's going to retreat anyway.
Hold that thought, Craig. We got to take an official break now. Coming up at the bottom of the hour. Coming on the other side, what would have happened if the South had won the war? You are listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Captain George McMurtry, wounded on two separate occasions, continued to lead his battalion in combat in World War I. Details after this.
An Air Force F-16 fighter jet accelerates from zero to the speed of sound in about a minute. But if you're looking to soar, there's something that can take you higher than any aircraft. A good education. So stay in school, graduate, and see how high you can climb. The future is wide open with that diploma in your hand. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
McMurtry was commander of a battalion which was cut off and surrounded by the enemy. And although wounded in the knee by shrapnel and suffering great pain, he continued throughout the entire period to encourage his officers and men with an optimism that contributed largely toward preventing panic and disorder among the troops who were without food and cut off from communications with our lines. During a heavy barrage, he personally directed and supervised the moving of the wounded to shelter before himself seeking shelter. 2 days later, he was again wounded, this time in the shoulder by a German grenade, but continued to personally organize and direct the defense against the German attack on the position until the attack was defeated. He continued to direct and command his troops, refusing relief, and personally led his men out of the position after assistance arrived before permitting himself to be taken to the hospital. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
For the past 100 years, Amish furniture craftsmen have placed great value upon the beauty and quality of their work, with great attention paid to the details of the wood. Each board is then hand-selected to match the specific furniture in mind and in achieving the desired look of the finished piece. At Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor Showroom, you will find displays of this fine craftsmanship that you can afford and own. Now is the time. You can visit Naked Furniture at 3570 Washtenaw Avenue and experience this fine quality for yourself. The furniture consultants at Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor are there to show you the fine details of Amish furniture. See for yourself the fine quality Amish furniture. Go to Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor, 3570 Washtenaw Avenue, or visit their website, nakedfurnitureofannarbor.com.
When Johnny comes marching home again, hurrah, hurrah, we'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah, hurrah, for the men who cheer the boys.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and the question today is, what would have happened if the South had won the Civil War? Our guests include Greg Simons, who's a professor emeritus of the United States Naval Academy, where he taught Civil War history for almost 30 years, and his Civil War book includes Gettysburg, A Battlefield Atlas. We've got Wayne Van Sant, who's the author and illustrator of The Graphic History of Gettysburg, which is a cool book with hand-drawn pictures of what, you know, what we thought went on at Gettysburg. And also we've got Dwight John Zimmerman, who wrote his book Uncommon Valor about the Medal of Honor, and we know that Dwight knows everything about history. So we're going to do that. So if you want to get in on this conversation, give us a call here at Veterans Radio, 877-573-7825. Just before the break, Wayne asked the question of Craig, what would have happened if the South had won at Gettysburg, and then maybe even eventually, and Wayne, you thought that they wouldn't have won the war. Craig, what do you think?
I think that's probably true. I think Lee was so encumbered with wounded and so low on supplies and especially munitions that he could not have sustained his army very long in Union territory. Now, he could have lived off the land, as, of course, armies would do in 1864 on both sides, but he couldn't have gotten the munitions, particularly the artillery ammunition that he needed. So at some point he has to even if he wins that battle, even if he finds a way to deliver the letter to Washington that said, let's have an armistice and let's talk, he probably can't stay there and must retreat. And I think the key thing about that allows the North to win the war, we all know about the numerical advantages the North has, the industrial infrastructure and so forth, but the real key is Abraham Lincoln. If Abraham Lincoln is reelected in 1864, that means the war is going to go on for another 4 years, and the South can't fight the war for another 4 years. So as long as Lincoln is elected, the North wins the war. So what the South needs to do is get Lincoln not elected. Now, the unknown here is the impact that a Union defeat at Gettysburg would have on the voting electorate right. in the following year's presidential election. Does Lincoln lose public support because it looks like the North is losing the war, and once Lincoln is out, if McClellan, who was the Democratic candidate, is elected president, he probably opens armistice discussions. So that's the way the South could win. But I think that to say if the South wins Gettysburg, it wins the war is a pretty long stretch. I think Wayne's right.
I tend to agree with both as well, because the strategic importance of the Western campaign and the Western theater was overshadowed by the symbolic right. importance of Richmond. And I would say that if Grant had lost at Vicksburg at about the same time, then certainly the South would have really got a boost to its morale and its chances. But if Lee had won at Gettysburg and Grant had won at Vicksburg, it'd be oversimplification to call it a wash, but certainly it would not have had the overwhelming strategic importance of swinging everything to the South's favor.
Well, my question to you, gentlemen, right now is, let's suppose, hypothetically, that somehow the South had been able to win the Civil War. We know that, or at least some of the readings I've been done, that a lot of the Northern soldiers' reenlistment time periods were coming up, and if the morale was low, they might have said, hey, we're out of here. They had a draft riot in New York shortly after Gettysburg that we haven't even touched on. And let's just suppose that the South had won the war. I'll start with you, Craig. What do you think would have happened? How would you see the 10 or 20 years after the Civil War?
Well, I think in the short term, the South does just fine. Cotton was still a dominant international marketable commodity, even though the British had opened new markets in India and Egypt and was working down on the supplies that they had. That cash crop commodity would have seen them in pretty good shape for a while. I think Britain would have wanted to associate itself. France already wanted to associate itself with the South. So for the near term, for the 10, 20 years after the war, the South probably does okay. After that, things get a lot grimmer. As the Industrial Revolution becomes more dominant, cotton by itself is not an economy that can sustain a modern nation for very long. I think the South would have become an international pariah because of its commitment to slavery, a kind of South Africa, if you would, where the rest of the nations of the world try to bring moral pressure to bear on them to do something about their labor system. And I really don't see how or if the South would have been willing to wean itself from slavery, because obviously they went to war to keep it, so they probably aren't going to let it go voluntarily as an independent nation. I think by the 20th century, the South is kind of a third world nation.
Wayne, any comments?
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, one thing I thought about with the independence of the different southern states, they could have possibly fragmented further. I'm not sure. And I wonder if just the moral issue in the North, if the North, the Union may have fragmented more. What about the western states? Mm-hmm. Some of them might have broke off. I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, it was impossible to say for sure. But, you know, and he's right about slavery. It was an evil institution, and what would have happened if it had gone on? What kind of repercussions would have been there? I don't know. But, hey, listen, I've always said it's great that the Union won. I was just always kind of snickered when the fact that the South did as well as it did the first couple of years. But who really knows?
I was reading about this, they thought that the country would fragment or split into separate countries almost.
Mm-hmm.
They figured that Texas would just go become independent again and, you know, continue on their own way. And then there was this group of states, as Wayne, as you mentioned, out in the Midwest, the Dakotas and so forth, that might form their own country. And it would almost end up being more like a big Europe with all these different regions with their own interests. Setting up their own governments.
Well, I don't think we would have developed. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, I would like to add that the Confederate Constitution had a fatal weakness there. This is amplifying something that Wayne just said, in that this whole issue of states' rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with Craig that the first 20 years, the South would have been able to get along. But inevitably, when you looked at the economic aspects of things, coupled with the political weakness of, by virtue of its constitution, I could see some states wanting to either return to the Union or, as it, particularly in the case of Texas, spin off as its own nation.
It's fascinating when you think about the possibility out there. And one article that I was reading was talking about the issue of slavery, of course, which is so valuable. But with the Industrial Revolution, as Craig, you mentioned there, if they start coming up with all these things, it's a lot cheaper to, process cotton and all the other things with machinery as it goes forward. And, in fact, it ends up being a lot cheaper to pay somebody to pick the cotton, even if it's, if it's freed slaves, $1 a day, but then they have to take care of themselves instead of, the slave owner housing them, feeding them, buying and selling them.
Yeah, the assumption has long been among many economists who deal with the question of slavery that if the circumstances emerge where it costs a slave owner more money to sustain his owned labor force, than he could obtain from them in terms of value, that he would make the smart economic decision and divest himself of his slave property. The problem is that for the 50 years in particular prior to the outbreak of the Civil War, slavery had become not just an economic system but also a social system, and the South had committed itself so strongly to the idea of racial superiority as a justification or slavery. You know, we are not bad people. They can't survive on their own.
Right.
They need us to sustain them. And that justification allowed them to be good people and good Christians and own slaves. So even once it becomes economically questionable, it's going to be very hard for the South to say, well, I guess we were completely wrong about everything we've believed for the last 150 years. You're free. That may have happened, but it would have taken a very long and very hard path before it ever happened. So I would say 100 years, probably.
Yes, and the other part, too, to amplify on what Craig said, is there was the underlying fear of slave rebellion, because there were many communities in which slaves far outnumbered the white community.
That's very true, and that was another issue that I saw, that they were, concerned about whether to, free the slaves and have them be the workforce, or, repatriate them, send them back to wherever they came from, which, they didn't want to do that because then they wouldn't have any labor. It's kind of fascinating to me to see what might have happened. Go ahead, Wayne.
This Wayne, I'm going to bring up a question just occurred to me. But not only what it would have done to us, but what it would have done to the international community is, as Craig say, probably about 100 years, you know, of this. And how would it have affected Europe and the rest of the world? I mean, with World War One and stuff like that, without our involvement or a different kind of involvement, the repercussions of that is going on forever and ever, it seems like.
Yeah. Now, this is Craig. I want to follow up on that because that's a great insight, Wayne. I like that a lot. By the way, Wayne, of all of us, you're probably the only one who doesn't need to introduce himself when you begin to talk. We know who you are.
I know. I understand that.
But I do want to say that in World War One, in particular, some of you may remember, and I'll do this in honor of Dwight, the Zimmerman telegram, which the Germans sent to Mexico saying, listen, if you join up with this, if the United States gets into war, if you ally yourselves with us, we'll let you recover all the territory you lost to the United States in the Mexican War. My guess is if the South wins a civil war and is a separate nation in 1914, that telegram goes to Richmond, not to Mexico City. And the South is invited to become a German ally. Well, now you've really got an interesting World War One scenario where the North and the South reinitiate combat with the South fighting on behalf of the Germans. Now, it's not necessarily would have happened, but it might have.
Yes, Craig, this is Dwight Zimmerman saying that is a very good point there. And not only that, then we'd have, it would have been truly a far greater global conflict because you would have had Mexico, you know, in on it. And suddenly Woodrow Wilson would have been faced with a fight not only in Europe, but also a second major war on the American continent.
Hold that thought and see what we're going to be doing after the next break about what would America be like if the South had won the Civil War. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio and kind of speculating what the world would be like if the South had won the Civil War. Our guests are Craig Simons, Wayne Van Sant, and Dwight John Zimmerman, kind of just thinking out loud about what the possibilities would be. Dwight, I wanted to just come back to you for a second. You said there was a fatal flaw in the Constitution of the Confederacy. Could you kind of remind us of that one?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Thank you. The fact was that contributing reason for the Confederacy to split was its dispute as to which was more important, the state government or the federal government. And the flaw in the Confederate Constitution was that the states held the final say in things. Now, of course, in practical terms, that really, it affected how the South fought the war, because it was really a, more than the federal government, it was a supplicant to the states to get the troops, get the supplies, get everything down the line. And of course, toward the end, when the South was losing, there were efforts by some of the states to try and get out of the Confederacy, but Jefferson Davis nixed that, interestingly enough. But the fact was that the states were given the primary authority within the, I'll call it a federal organization or a national government organization.
Well, didn't we try that with the Articles of Confederation and found that it didn't work so well?
That is true. That's why we had our Constitutional Convention, and thus the whole round of horse trading that occurred thereof. And even at that point, it took until Andrew Jackson to really establish firmly the primacy of the federal government. Well, he became known infamously as King Andrew, but he established a very powerful presidency, the executive department.
It's interesting. There was a website that I was looking at that was, you know, the question was, what if the South had won? And many of the comments that were on there were of the, you know, oh, we would have state rights, everything would be great, and you know, we wouldn't have the federal government interfering in our lives. And actually, one of the comments was the Second Amendment was that the guns weren't there to protect us from grizzly bears. It was there to protect us from the government.
Right.
I thought was rather interesting. Who said right?
Oh, that was Wayne. Yeah, okay. That's so right, yeah.
And, you know, so it to me it's fascinating. And you know, we got a couple of minutes left. Any other comments from the three of you about where you think we would be today if the South had won, other than having all of us would be talking like Wayne?
Well, I tell you, is that the you know, as I remember the old book, Harry Turtledove's Guns of the South, made it look pretty rosy if the South had won. But I think, you know, somebody might, you know, a lot of these things I haven't even thought about until this conversation this morning. Somebody might need to do a little more research on this and a little more speculation. It could be an interesting book there somewhere.
I think that the big group that would benefit the most would have been Europe. Because the major powers in Europe, they wanted the Union to lose. They saw the United States as a threat, both economically and, more importantly, politically, because we were the first republic. We were, as a government, the great experiment. And you had these constitutional and these absolute monarchies in Europe that had a vested political interest in the Union losing.
There's a book that I had found the other day, and it was called If the South Had Won the Civil War. It was printed in 1961 by an author named McKinley Cantor. And I don't know if he's a famous historian, so one of you may have heard the name before. But it's If the South Had Won the Civil War. And his premise was, what would have happened if Grant had gotten killed in Vicksburg? And he kind of goes forward from there. And how the war would have played out, but I just think it's fascinating. I want to get a final comment from each of you about the Civil War and the importance of it in American history. I'll give you about a minute each, starting with Dwight.
Okay, the impact, you know, cannot be overstated. I have to say that when I was young, the war that I was fascinated most about was World War II. Well, my father had fought in it, and I was reading a lot of the histories on that, and I felt that the Civil War was overstated. But as I got older and was seeing the real impact, especially with the loss of life, which has recently been, the actual number has actually been increased and significantly, and the result is that it is a defining moment. It changed society irrevocably in the United States. We went from the United States are a nation to the United States is a nation, and that philosophical shift is just absolutely enormous. Since I don't have any more time to talk about that,
We'll continue this on. Wayne?
Okay. Well, you know, as I say, I think he's right. As I was growing up, my main interest was World War II, but I've gone back. And I look at the Civil War as part of the American Revolution. Most revolutions in this world have been bloody. They have just dissolved to chaos and murder. And ours didn't seem to during the time of the Revolution. But I think the Civil War, it was just a delayed reaction to that.
Sort of a final note on the Revolution.
Yeah, very much. That's pretty much my thoughts on it, yeah.
Craig?
Yeah, I think Wayne's. I think both Dwight and Wayne are correct here. I think the Civil War is important to us historically because it finally defined us as a people. I think the idea of the United States being a great experiment is crucial to all this. The rest of the world was waiting for this democracy business to fail so they could say, see, you absolutely have to have the divine right of kings. It's the only way you can rule people because they're irresponsible. They cannot govern themselves. So the Civil War demonstrated that a nation tolerant enough to allow people to state their views could still be strong enough to sustain itself. And that's why it's important. It's also important because, again, as Dwight said, that it made the United States a single nation, not a collection of individual sovereignties. So it made us what we are today, which I think is a pretty darn good thing. So I guess I have to say that the sacrifice was worth it.
I have to agree with all three of you gentlemen. I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio today. And, you know, sharing all your information and knowledge, I think it's valuable, and I hope our audience appreciates, and I want to thank all of you.
Buy the books.
Yeah, buy all their books.
Hey,
their books.
Absolutely.
Buy all the books.
And we'll get you on. Thanks, thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye. I wanted to save a little time here just to talk a little bit, of course, to our audience about this. This is the type of programming we do. But the inspiration for many of these programs and finding out who these authors are and who these heroes of the American military are is from our former partner, Gary Lilly. Mm-hmm. And Gary, as I mentioned at the top of the program, has been gone for 2 years now. And we get all emotional when we start thinking about the impact that Gary not only had on all the veterans out there, but especially on two veterans that are sitting here right now in the control room.
You know, he found himself at when he came aboard. There was something about Gary that had a journalistic soul, that he had something inside of him, stories, things.
Well, he finally had access to a way to tell these stories that he'd had.
Besides
those years.
Besides the VFW newsletter.
Yeah, right, and just meetings, because, you know, we had talked to people about this, and many of the people in the local Vietnam veterans and the local military, you know, veterans associations have said, Gary had always been fascinated with these stories, and we all came together and had the ability to get these stories out.
I used to love to have him as a co-host because I could just, he would come up with a question that even I would, yeah, where'd you get that, man?
Well,
it was entertaining and everything for all of us as part of it.
So, Gary, you know, we hardly knew you. We miss you desperately. And there's going to be a special ceremony at the Yankee Air Museum in November honoring Gary Lilly as one of the local area's veterans. We'll be back next week. You are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.